Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. All eyes are focused on Iran. Will Trump order an attack, or is he searching for an off-ramp? Also, 4 years ago, the special military operation in Ukraine commenced. Are we now close to the end? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. Our gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Mark here in Moscow. As I said in the introduction, the whole world is focused on what Trump is going to do vis-a-vis Iran. All of us have talked about this at great length. I don't see any logic. I don't understand the timing. I don't understand what Trump wants to achieve and for whom. And so I'm just going to hand the baton to you, Mark, and you can do the heavy lifting for me. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think this is, the package that was presented. This is the ultimate culmination of Trump's Israel First foreign policy. Which has long been, you know, what Trump evidently campaigned on and won the election on, putting Israel first and foremost in its foreign policy. So it is quite obvious that the Netanyahu regime in Israel and members of the Trump regime in the United States that are directing Trump on this feel there is a closing window of political and geopolitical opportunity to get the U.S. involved in a direct war with Iran on their behalf, which they hope will result in regime change in Iran. That is unquestionably the goal. Trump has said so himself. That would be the best outcome. Everything else is a red herring. And the timing is that Trump is very much closing on midterm elections, and he is going to be focused on that. And if he loses control of Congress to the Democrats, that is going to seriously restrict his power. He's going to be under almost repeated impeachments for the rest of his term in office. And he is already going to be locked in a battle with the Supreme Court, which has smacked down his tariffs war on the world. So he has a whole host of domestic problems that are going to eat up his presidency probably for the remainder of his term. So politically, they see this as a very limited window of opportunity, and they believe they will never have a U.S. president who is more Absolutely. Willing and pliant and manipulatable to ensure Israel's goals in the Middle East. Geopolitically, there is also the fact that Iran keeps growing their long-range strike retaliatory capability, and there is every reason to believe now that they are seriously engaged with Russia and with China in the what will be a lengthy construction of an integrated, interconnected, multi-layered air defense and electronic warfare system. But once that is in place, that closes down the geopolitical window of opportunity. They will no longer be able to move on Iran because of obviously the strength of Russian air defenses. So before that gets in place, they would like to act as well. That's why the timing and the rationale as I see it.
Yeah, well, you know, Mark, I think you broke one of your own rules. You used the word "the hope is." Okay, so let me go to George here. Hope, that's not a geopolitical currency I like to trade in. Okay, because Mark, everything Mark says is absolutely right. But what if it goes sideways? All of the problems facing Donald Trump, plus a forever war in Iran. The stakes are amazingly high when you consider Iran is not threatening anyone right now, George.
Well, that's right. And that's really the problem for Trump, because let's keep in mind, Trump campaigned both in 2016 and in 2024 on being very different from George W. Bush. No return to Bush Cheney, no more forever wars, no more regime change wars. That's what he campaigned on. He never said, well, you know what we're going to do is deal with Iran as first order of business. So he never said that. And really, he has never said, other than that comment that Mark pointed to, that he said about a week or 10 days ago, suggesting, well, we would all be better off if there was the government went in Tehran went away, which is a fairly, fairly meaningless, trite kind of comment. All American politicians say something like that. He has never outlined that as a goal of the United States. Look, we've seen in the past when we had regime change wars, what do U.S. presidents say? Assad must go. Gaddafi must go. Milosevic must go. Trump has never said that. Now, at the same time, you'd have to say that the goals... No, he hasn't said that. Stop that. See, he hasn't
talked
said
about
that.
The assassination of Khomeini openly. What are you talking
he is
about?
He talked about... Look, did he do that? Did he attempt to assassinate Khomeini? When he launched his attacks, it was a very limited strike. Not only was it a limited strike on the Iran's nuclear facilities, which was consistent with all he kept seeing with nuclear weapons, but he called it off the very next day. He said, that's it. We did what we did. And he called it off the very next day and allowed Iran to make this token strike on Qatar, the U.S. base in Qatar. So what I'm saying is that... Trump, because he has allowed himself to make these sort of vague comments about nuclear weapons, and that is that's a deal that is clearly open to him, mm-hmm. then a deal is there to be had. I mean, it's there, and I think he may still take it. I mean, I think he's still sufficiently cautious, sufficiently cunning, not to get himself into what would be an absolutely disastrous, Bush-Cheney, super plus war in the Middle East.
Well, Mark, is it doable with the assets that the United States has assembled in the Persian Gulf and in the region here? This in boom out, is that a possibility? Because through leaks, I've got purposeful leaks, the New York Times and the Washington Post have hinted it could be weeks long, months long. When I hear weeks long, months long, I get scared because that means there aren't really meaningful benchmarks, Mark.
So the goal is regime change, whatever people may want to pretend. The goal has always been regime change. Trump truthed about regime change in the midst of the last U.S.-facilitated Israeli attacks on Iran last year. And the whole a bombing charade had nothing to do with Iran's nuclear program.
Where was the regime change? What happened to it?
It didn't happen because Israel was incapable.
Well, because they weren't even remotely close to it.
They attempted decapitation strikes against the entirety of the Iranian
gentlemen. The Americans had one file, and the Israelis had a different one. They were different files. Okay, keep going, Mark.
So that was just a face-saving gesture to pull Israel to save their bacon out of a fire that they were beginning to lose a long-range strike war of attrition. Drop some bombs, declare victory, and then prepare for the next war. Well, we're at the next war right now. And it is obvious that the U.S. believes or hopes, again, I'm not hoping, they're hoping, that's the problem, they can complete a decapitation strike that Israel failed to achieve last year. That is their only hope, because the U.S. still has the same Achilles heel of insufficient air and missile defense capacity and interceptors to defend their bases and Israel, exactly what happened last year. I do not believe Trump any longer has the window to, however clumsily, back out of his belligerency and threats. Too much has been moved into theater. Too much has been said. And now his credibility as the type of cretinous, belligerent mafia bully that he is on the line. He's made too many threats against the Iranian leadership, against the Iranian government. And if he doesn't follow through, he will be seen as the weak, small-fisted little thing that he is.
Well,
Okay, this is all being done for Israel, right? Let's be very clear about this.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think he is doing this for Israel. I think there was some sort of a quid pro quo with Netanyahu. You got Netanyahu aboard for his 20-point Gaza plan. Netanyahu is now on this board of peace, and this is now Trump's baby. He wants to go ahead with this, with this whole Gaza program, board of peace, technocratic government. He got Netanyahu to agree to this and essentially call off his war in Gaza. So as a quid pro quo, he does this thing in Iran. However, there's no hope. He has no hope of achieving regime change or anything really in Iran. So therefore, knowing that, I mean, he can just simply do, I think, symbolic strikes, allow Iran to make symbolic strikes. And then, I mean, you know, if we look at all of the reports that have been coming out, whether it's the New York Times and the Axios, there is clearly a deal that is to be made. And the notion that somehow he's going to walk away and he's sort of, you know, whatever, you know, he'll be seen to be a coward. No one is going to say that. Everyone will be relieved that it's over and that this war has come to an end. It's hard to see why Trump would want to get himself into something that's going to be a long, protracted war, months and months, with Iran. That will be a disaster for him. And not only is it a disaster, it could actually endanger his own presidency. I mean, you could say, you know, it's impossible that his colleagues will invoke the 25th Amendment. And they say, maybe he's just simply off his rocker. I mean, he got into this war for no reason, because at least Bush and Cheney had the ostensible reason of 9/11. So that's why knowing Trump, knowing what a sort of, you know, rather cunning figure that he is, I don't think he's going to go down this path of a protracted war with Iran.
Mark, is Iran being underestimated?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the same categorical mistake that the U.S., its intelligence, quote unquote, right, always makes with regards to its adversaries. And this is a result of their ideological exceptionalism, their belief in their own societal, structural, and above all, moral superiority. They underestimated Russia. They underestimated its resolve, its military strength, its military industrial capacity, its economy. They did the same thing disastrously so with the strength of China's economy. And they're betting on, they have to believe in the fragility of the Iranian government and the, as far as I'm concerned, repeatedly debunked idea that the Iranian people, at least the majority of them, don't support their government. And if they just drop some bombs and kill a few leaders, that the Iranian people will rise up and overthrow. This is the type of blinkered Manichaean thinking that dominates Washington
You could sum it up in one word: hubris. All right, gentlemen, yes. I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. All right, let's change gears. George, the special military operation is about 4 years old. It's lasted longer than the Great Patriotic War, also known as the Second World War. At least for as far as the Soviet Union / now today Russia, it's lasted a lot longer than most people thought. I know Mark was one of the very few outliers. I remember it. And you said this was going to be a long one. You were in a big argument with somebody. Everybody knows we don't have to go there, but you got the better of that argument here. George, is there any indication to you that are we at the end of the beginning? Are we in the middle? At the end of what phrase would you use using in February 2026?
I don't think we're close to the beginning of the end. I mean, I think that both sides are really, you know, dug in for a long protracted conflict. I mean, we have these negotiations. We had the negotiations recently in Abu Dhabi, and we had negotiations in Geneva. It doesn't look as if there's any movement towards any kind of agreement. And on the contrary, we've seen Zelensky and his, particularly his European patrons, you know, essentially saying, we're not going to make any concessions whatsoever. We're just going to continue. And, you know, we have the Europeans, you know, talking about spending, you know, spending more money, continuing with this war. Russia has set its agenda. I mean, they've spelled it out. And Russia has actually been, you know, more flexible than Ukraine has been. But it's, and I think it's just simply so unlikely that Russia will make the kind of concessions that the Europeans and you know, I think the Americans, in this case, Trump just really doesn't care very much about the Europeans and Ukraine ones. Right? I don't think Russia's going to make those concessions. And I don't think Ukraine and the Europeans will make the concessions. So I think this is going to go on. And I think, and I hear, I'd agree with, I think Mark said something recently, that even if, you know, the Russians take the Donbass and then Kherson and Zaporozhye, the war does not come to an end. And I think that even if, and then even if going further, if Russia takes Kiev, the war does not come to an end. I mean, this is something that this is going to be an existential war that's going to go on for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, Mark, one of the problems with my question is the end in sight. What does end mean? That's even ambiguous here. Go ahead.
Yes, I think you actually you kind of in an aside you hit on the truth of it. We are not at the beginning of the end. We are at the end of the beginning. At some time this year, Russia is going to fully liberate the last of the Donetsk People's Republic. They're going to close up the last defensive line in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And then there will be theoretically a moment where Russia will look at NATO, it will look at the United States and the Europeans and say, are you done yet? And they will say no. And then Russia will say, withdraw from Kherson and Zaporozhye now. We've already taken Donbass. And they'll say no. And they'll say, okay. They'll be moving on a siege of Zaporozhye City before the end of this year. Next year, Russia will be crossing the Dnieper moving on Odessa and Kiev. That's where the conflict will going. The Kiev regime will keep fighting. Europe and the United States will keep arming them to the best of their ability, which is not very much right now because of the problems with ramping up their military industrial complex for this, really for any type of war, but particularly for this type of war. And Russia is a continually achieving faster results, because the Kiev regime, with its manpower woes, is less and less capable of defending. Everything there right now is they are hoping on drones and robots produced by Europe to continue this conflict. And Zelensky just talked yesterday about 3 more years of war before, as he sees it, they have victory. So that tells you the type of delusional mental space they're occupying right now. And I believe we are further than ever from any type of diplomatic settlement. The Kiev regime, with U.S. control of its intelligence agencies, just tried to assassinate one of the negotiators a few weeks ago. They tried to assassinate Putin a month before that. Of course, there's no hope of any negotiated settlement. And this will go on to Kiev and Lvov and the Polish border. And then Russia will be fighting a guerrilla war waged outside of Europe itself that they're already preparing for.
Well, and the Europeans, in total, what Mark just said, the Europeans are fully on board for what Mark had to say.
Yes, they are. And I think Europeans are preparing for this. So amidst all the talk that Russia is planning to invade in 2030, and then we need to be prepared for this war with Russia in 2030. I mean, just, you know, turn it around and say, in other words, you are planning on getting into this war in 2030, which is what they're saying. And so with daily, there's the daily deluge of propaganda within the European media of all the terrible things Russia's doing. Russia's waging a cyber war against us. Russia's intruding in our airspace. Russia's sabotaging our infrastructure. Russia's doing this. Russia's doing that. In order to prepare the peoples of Europe for this coming war. It's going to, you know, it takes time, but 2030 is the time frame in which they're moving. So there's no prospect at all for any kind of a settlement, and all these negotiations are only being engaged in by Russia and Ukraine just to keep Trump happy. That's the only way that they, in other words, like keep him on board, and so they all make all the noise. Yes, we're going to show up to these talks. And the most that they ever agree on is always the same thing. Oh, we'll have a prisoner of war exchange. There's a prisoner of war exchange. And then Trump will say, yeah, well, we're very close to an agreement. There's no prospect at all of any kind of a deal anytime soon.
And Mark, that suits Zelensky and his circle. They stay in power and they continue to be paid. I mean, what's wrong with that? If it's not broken, why fix it?
It isn't, and they're not going to fix it. They're going to continue to forcibly press gang, conscript as much of their population as they're able to throw. And they've talked repeatedly about lowering the conscription age to teenagers and sending women forcibly if that's what they need to do. And I have no doubts that Zelensky and the rest of the regime there will go down that path. If that is what they need to do, they're still just they cannot accept Russia's terms. They just from political, from ideological, however you want to, you know, a visceral. They cannot accept a Russian victory. So they will fight literally to the last Ukrainian that they can forcibly throw in front of them to the end. And then they'll decamp. And Zelensky will get an apartment together with that Muchado woman and Svetlana Tikhanovskaya and Juan Guaido. And they can all pretend that they are, U.S. installed rulers of country together in an apartment in Brooklyn somewhere. Maybe we could set up a reality show and we could vote them out of the apartment. I would watch that. I would seriously watch that.
George, is this a war of attrition, but in a different set? It's the meaning, can the Europeans last this out? We see political instability, but to shore that up, we have greater censorship, banning of political parties, not allowing some political figures to run for office, and this is all part and parcel with the Ukraine project.
No, I think it is, and I think there's greater and greater political repression, and the various kind of populist movements that potentially could be a problem for European leaders can easily be defeated. The election in Hungary, that's very much up in the air. It's less than 2 months away now, 50 days to go. Viktor Orban is underwater in the polls. He might pull it off, but he's still underwater in the polls. Once he's gone, then the entire populist opposition to this war plan will have taken a severe blow. Yes, I mean, Fico would still be there, but Orban is the leader of this anti-war, so to speak, populist movement in Europe. And then you can start applying pressure against movements like the Alternative for Deutschland party, against Le Pen in France, and essentially eliminate all opposition to these war plans. And I think that, you know, the sort of Merz-Macron plan of mobilizing Europe, I think there'll be almost no opposition to that at all.
We have 1 minute left, Mark. Will the three of us be having a similar conversation exactly 1 year from now?
I just think it'll be at higher stakes at that point. We'll be talking about crossing the Dnieper. We'll be talking about direct European intervention. I mean, Lindsey Graham openly said it at Munich, human tripwire force. He said the words, right? He said tripwire force.
Well, Mark, I want to bring you back to something you said earlier and really quickly. But if Trump's Iran gambit goes south, how will that impact the Ukraine conflict?
The price of oil is already going up, and that, of course, is going to benefit Russia, and the U.S. will get bogged down and waste military assets that will set back any possibility of direct intervention in Ukraine, and also of any, you know, fantasy pivot to Asia that U.S. presidents have dreamed of since Obama, but always gotten bogged down in the Middle East.
Bogged down. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my my guests in Moscow and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RTC. And next time, remember, Crosstalk rules.